Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, award-winning author and University of Texas at Austin professor, Ashley D. Farmer, talks about her latest book, Queen Mother, Black Nationalism, Reparations, and the Untold Story of Audre Moore. It was published by Pantheon in November 2025, and in January of this year, Farmer was interviewed via Zoom by fellow biographer and bio member Tamara Payne.
Hello, Dr. Ashley Farmer. Welcome to Bio. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you doing?
We're great here in New York. So we're going to talk to you today about your book on Queen Mother Moore. First of all, I just want to congratulate you on getting it published and writing it. This was a monumental project, even on a great and nice and long life.
Mother yes. Moore.
So she's important to us here in New York. And learning that she is also important in Louisiana. And, you know, she has plotted her home throughout the South and then ended up in New York. So we love her here in Harlem. So when did you first learn about Queen Mother Moore? And let's talk to the audience about who she is.
Yeah, so I actually happened upon her through other activists. The first book I wrote, Remaking Black Power, was a history of Black women in the Black Power movement. And I interviewed both men and women for that book. And almost everybody had a story about Queen Mother Moore. They had met her and it was the first time that they had heard about reparations, perhaps for some of them, the first time they'd heard about Garvey. And they were always kind of attracted to the ability for her to translate her message broadly, but also just incredible organizing life. And so, you know, I immediately went to go look her up and could find almost nothing on her save a couple recollections of herself and those of other activists. So every now and then I would just kind of return to it because I was like, how is it this woman who is so important in the Black freedom movement, particularly among radical Black activists, have so little on her? So it was kind of a labor of love of putting together things over the course of 10 years, just to whenever I happened upon something about her, I just kind of put it aside. And I like to say sometimes she maybe haunted me a little bit. I couldn't put it away, even though I was working on other projects.
Yeah, and that's kind of how great ideas for biography projects kind of grab you. They won't let you go. But I am curious, can you share any of the stories that you had heard that kind of made you want to dive further?
Yeah, absolutely. So several organizers, their first real big event was what we call the Gehring Convention in Gary, Indiana, in March of 1972. And there they had not only seen this woman who, by that point, she's in her 70s because Moore was born in 1898 and died in 1997. And they said that she would just like float through the halls of the West Side Gym in her complete African regalia. But it was when she spoke and she demanded reparations, and she had this really funny way of doing it where she was deadly serious and had a political analysis, but she was also very witty. And she talked about how all of their last names couldn't be Johnson and White, and how, you know, their hair was a certain way because the white man had their way with their ancestors. So they had never heard somebody kind of combine that level of political analysis with kind of this humor and ability to kind of corral folks. And they learned from speaking with her that that's because she used to be a street corner speaker. She learned a lot of her way of galvanizing people, one through following Marcus Garvey and the UNIA in the 1920s, but then when she moved to Harlem and joined the Communist Party in the 1930s and 40s. So like I said, when they were at this Gehring Convention in March of 1972, they would see her passing, handing out her pamphlets for reparations. And it was from there that some of them got involved in the reparations fight, somebody like a Charles Ogletree. And there were others who integrated reparations into kind of their radical nationalist organizing. And then when I talked to people in New Orleans, they remembered her group that she created in the 1950s. The Universal Association of Ethiopian Women, which was obviously a play on Garvey's UNIA. And they remembered that in the mid-century, in the 1950s and 1960s, she was helping get Black men exonerated from death row. and helping Black women on welfare. So it just was an incredible array of stories that told me that she had a remarkable life. And I was absolutely stunned that no one had kind of put it together.
Yeah, and you do a wonderful job of bringing that together in your book. First of all, let's talk about Marcus Garvey. When did she first meet Marcus Garvey?
Yeah, so Moore is living and working in New Orleans. She was born in New Iberia, but they moved there into New Orleans as a young child. She was about 3 or 4. And then both her father and her mother died before she reaches the age of 20. So she was kind of among the Black Creole elite in New Orleans at the beginning of her life. But after the death of her father in particular, she slides down the class ladder and has to become a domestic worker to survive. And milling about in New Orleans among dock workers and domestic workers, she comes across a man named Josiah Spraggs, who is from Jamaica and knew Marcus Garvey, but also had worked for the United Fruit Company as well. He is the one that kind of introduces her to Marcus Garvey, and she goes to the Longshoremen's Hall, this beautiful two-story building that certainly was for the longshoremen, but just kind of a community center for Black New Orleanians of the working class. And as she's walking in, she's walking slow because she, as she tells it, has a gun in her bra, a 45, so not a small gun, and one in her pocketbook, and her husband has a set of bullets, and that's because they are expecting perhaps a confrontation with the police as they're waiting to hear Marcus Garvey speak that night. The night before, the police had barred him from speaking because of his reputation for rousing Black people to action. And so the Black people of New Orleans came ready to defend his right to speak. So in he comes, she says, and he bounds down and he says, "My friends, I'm so sorry that I didn't get to speak to you last night." And at that point, the police come, and as she says, they raise their guns and say, "I'll run you in," or "We'll arrest you," right? She says that everybody gets up and responds in kind, and the Black folks pull out their guns and yell, "Speak, Garvey, speak, speak, Garvey, speak." And the police go out of there with their tail between their legs. And this is a transformative moment for a young girl who's down on her luck. She saw Black people defend themselves and win against a white police mob. And then she sat down and listened to a man talk about how she is descended from kings and queens and how she should have pride in her hair and in her skin, and how the problems that Black people had in Cairo were the same as South Carolina and the same as Cuba. And this kind of helped develop not only her Black nationalism, but also her global Pan-African analysis.
How old was she when this happened?
Yeah, it's 1922, so give or take, a couple
Okay.
years, early 20s.
What was her life like growing up in New Orleans or outside New Orleans? What was her sense of self like?
That's a really interesting question. So, because her father had kind of come from slavery and made the most of what Reconstruction had to offer, he became a constable, he was a voter, he was a landowner, he was a business owner. He was able to marry into a class of women, a Creole class, and her mother was very educated, spoke several languages, and had been like a playmate to white people in the South, so had a certain kind of culture and conditioning because of that. So they certainly were Black people that believed that they had a right to the American dream, but they were also Black people that believed in self-defense. Her father often defended both her reputation and her body, sometimes with a gun, and defended his family. Also, somebody who felt he had the right to vote and to own his own businesses and determine what his life would be like. So there was a sense of racial pride, but also a sense of class inferiority that were baked both into her early childhood. And I think Garvey caught on to that sense of racial pride, but also taught her that her kind of fidelity to capitalism was not the way to go, especially after she slid down the class ladder.
And after her father dies, would you say that she was still loyal to capitalism, or this because this is the way of the world that she wanted to get back to her prior social standing prior to her father's death?
Yeah, I think she was very much still invested in that. And, she says when she met Garvey, she before she wanted to be rich white, then she wanted to be rich Black. But she still wanted to be rich. It isn't until she leaves New Orleans and she is part of the group of great migrants who go to Harlem in the early to mid 1920s. By that time, Garvey's work has dissipated because he's been deported, and the Communist Party is there. And she joins them because they talk about Black self-determination and Black nationhood, but also because they help Black people every day. and they put, you know, your furniture back in when you've been evicted during the Great Depression. They feed you, they clothe you. And so as a result, she finds the Communist Party to be a place that she can organize. And it also gives her a really interesting class analysis that she did not have as a Garveyite.
And also because the Communist Party at that point, they were really interested in reaching out to the black citizens, around the country, and particularly in New York at that time. How long was she in the Communist Party? Because she does end up leaving it.
Quite some time. She spent most of the 30s, all of the 40s, and the first half of the 50s in the Communist Party. And it was an exciting time. It more so than, say, the NAACP, or even to some extent the UNIA, made space for Black women to organize. And she joined a group of women that included Claudia Jones, Louise Thompson Patterson, you know, Vicki Garvin, and they took the world by storm, organizing for Black rights during the middle of the century.
Yeah, and that is important to know about that. In the Communist Party, she's really gaining her education and building her communication skills and her community building. Because it's in New York where she really gets that title, Queen Mother, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So she ends up leaving the Communist Party in the 1950s. She is disappointed by their inability to embrace and let Black people lead their own programs, and also that they relinquished their original idea in the 1920s, which got her started, that Black people were a nation within a nation and had the right to self-determination. It's also no coincidence that it's the 1950s and we're in the height of McCarthy hysteria, right? And so she leaves. But while she's trying to kind of figure out what her next step is, she actually meets a group of African students who need her help. And Moore was always somebody, whenever there was a wrong, she tried to fix it the best she could. And they had no place to eat, no place to study. And so she got a little storefront, as the story goes, and set up for them to do their homework, got them a little typewriter. And they were so thankful for a person to kind of give them a warm place to stay and a place to help them thrive, that they began calling her Queen Mother. So it's in the 1950s, after she leaves the Communist Party, that she kind of begins to go back to embracing this idea that she's a Queen Mother, that she's a Black nationalist, and that she can be a mother of a movement.
And also, she's speaking about human rights too, correct?
Absolutely. It's no coincidence that after World War II, right, when we've had a massive Holocaust and people are thinking about how we don't repeat these things, Black people are thinking about all of the years of social, psychological, cultural, economic discrimination and dehumanization, and quite frankly, killing, right, that they've endured. And she realizes that she needs to kind of reframe her thinking beyond just America to these are really basic human rights. The right to self-determination, the right to free governance are things that people should be claiming all over the world, Black, white, whoever. And so it certainly helps her kind of develop her Pan-Africanism more, but also it's a moment when she appeals for the Black condition through the language of human rights.
It's interesting because that's happening in the 1950s, and she does meet Malcolm X, but when Malcolm X leaves the Nation of Islam in 1963, that's where you really hear him speaking about human rights. But she did meet Malcolm X, and she was one of his mentors, and was also giving him more grounding, right, in the human rights discussion. Because we document the meeting in our book where he really shares this idea of talking about human rights instead of just civil rights to other civil rights leaders who were working with Martin Luther King after he had departed the nation. So it's really interesting in reading in your book how, through the work that Queen Mother Moore is doing, that she's getting this training, this foundation, this grounding, this developing this language and conversation with us. And not just African students either, right? Because she's also African American students. And it's funny because I have come across people who said that they knew her and that when they were looking for help with services in Harlem, she was very informative and helping with directions. So she spoke with everybody, in the community. And that's why she's so loved here in Harlem too. But I want to also kind of go back a little bit and talk about the research because as we're talking about how important she is, and she's talking about women's rights, she's talking about human rights, she's talking about even when we talk about people who have been jailed and wrongfully convicted. All of this work is important, but how do you do research about this? Because you mentioned already that her archives was very small.
Yeah, so for someone who lived almost 100 years, she has no traditional archive to speak of. There's no place, where you can go open box one, folder one, and see everything, or even a set of places. I had thought that maybe the issue was is that her family had had most of her stuff, but after forming a relationship with her only child, Tom, I realized that most of it had been, scattered and lost. Some people said that when she was older and she was headed into a nursing home, people came and took some of the stuff that she had. Others say that it wasn't really documented because she was a radical woman and, she was trying to fly beneath kind of the radar of the state. Some people say that they have the stuff, and I've met people that say that they have some of her belongings from that apartment. So the point here is no one really knows where it all is. And that is why it was, so hard to kind of pull her life together. What's really interesting, though, is that because we don't have this big kind of archive, one of the best accountings of her day-to-day movements is actually her FBI file. The government followed her from the 1920s to the 1970s, and sometimes documenting, day by day, hour by hour, who she
Day
was
by day,
with,
hour by.
sometimes. Yeah, I mean, cutting out the newspaper clipping saying she went to this meeting, talked to this person, then it had lunch, and then went to this meeting. So I say that I'll say is that one of the really interesting things about craft and writing these kinds of things for Black radical women is sometimes you have to start with state surveillance, and there's some real questions of ethics around that. But if it's going to be used, it's got to be triangulated, with other sources as well. But slowly and surely, I've found a lot of stuff in people's attics and in people's basements. Once word got out that I was writing the book, I'd sometimes come home to packages where people had sent me, just flyers and things that they had had. And I found a way to kind of triangulate where she might have been and find her in archives that weren't necessarily labeled with her name or, anything related to her, but you might find her mentioned here and there. So it certainly was scattered far and wide all over the globe to try to figure out her life.
Yeah, the triangulation is really an interesting part of the work here, where you kind of have to see who is she adjacent to, and then sometimes even who they were adjacent to, and you might find valuable information in those connections. Who are you able to interview that was helpful in writing your book?
I formed a great relationship with her family. She has one son who's still alive. He's in his 90s and goes swimming at the Salvation Army
Wow.
every day and can talk about these stories like it was yesterday. It's really astounding. He had three daughters who more often took on her trips abroad in her 70s and 80s, in part to expose her grandchildren, but also because she needed the help, to travel. So they were really interesting to kind of get these plans when she went to Jamaica and when she went to Nigeria and when she went to Ghana and when she went to Uganda. I talked to adults who had gone with her on these trips as well, particularly to Tanzania and Uganda. Also talked with other activists that she mentored. For example, Dr. Muhammad Ahmed, who lives in Philadelphia, who was the head of the Revolutionary Action Movement and a big mentee of Moore, and myriad other activists who were with her at the Gary Convention, who were with her at Black Power conferences, Sonia Sanchez, who was a huge confidant of hers. So it really ran the gamut.
So you said Sonia Sanchez was a confidant?
Yes. They were great friends. I think that she might have thought that Sonia was going to, in the end, write her biography. Although, after speaking with Sonia, she gave me her blessing to do so. But they spent many hours together. She often stayed with Sonia if she was traveling, particularly to Philadelphia. And Sonia was one of the only women to actually speak at her funeral in the end because of their close relationship.
Oh, wow. Okay. And talk about her trips to Africa and traveling abroad and how that also continued, because she started traveling outside of the country late. So she's lived already a very full life.
Yeah, absolutely. So although she adored Africa and kind of in some ways kind of idolized it and essentialized it, she did not actually step foot on African soil until 1972. So again, she's born in 1898, so she's lived, most of her life by then. She went for the initial time for Kwame Nkrumah's funeral. And there is where she was formally installed as a queen mother of the Ashanti tribe through a ceremony. So she had been using the title of queen mother for about 20 years, but that was a real moment that was transformative to her. But it also shows how much people in Africa knew of her that they call for the ceremony. She went to Tanzania twice, both for major Pan-African congresses. One, the big one, the sixth Pan-African Congress, and secondly for the All-African Women's Conference. And I think there she got to meet not only incredible heads of state and leaders from African liberations movements, but it also was really sobering for her. She realized that, a black man in front of a black state doesn't solve all of your problems instantly. And she really learned about the nuances of different African cultures. I also talk about in the book that she went to Uganda with Idi Amin.
What was her thoughts on Idi Amin?
My girl adored Idi Amin, so much so that it almost made her betray a lot of her values of human rights and self-determination that she had advocated. She thought he could do no wrong and many times excused his awful atrocities and genocide in favor of him kind of being what she used to say was, a king's got to do what a king's got to do. Very problematic. But I include that part so you understand that you can get so caught up in this idea of kind of a black strong man that you start to think about it uncritically.
Yeah. And that's an important nuance to understand about our subjects and how they can get caught up with these ideologies, right? Because again, that was something we had to deal with Malcolm X and his relationship with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and how that formed him. But yeah, that is really interesting about Idi Amin in particular. But how did that, in coming back to the United States, how does that expand her thinking now that she's actually been to the continent? Because I know that she had very controversial ideas.
It reinforced some. For example, Queen Mother Moore was no feminist. She very much believed in men as the head of state, men as the head of family. She advocated for polygamy in part because she felt it brought us closer to ancient African cultures, but also because she felt that it was best considering that there were black men in jail and black women needed partners, which is extraordinarily problematic. I think that it also made her advocate for support and US support and Black American support for different African countries differently. She realized that it wasn't kind of a one size fits all solution,
Right.
that not only just with diplomatic relations between the US, but also Black American support, what different African communities needed from us differed, and she didn't really understand that until she went to Africa.
So, and this long life, and she's seen so much, I mean, almost 100 years, which is quite amazing. And there's this thing that you say often about, on one hand, she's seen a lot, she's been almost everywhere all the time. She's there in the background somewhere. But how does this help us in looking at her and making this an important story for us to read now? Because I do think that it is important that we understand her story and her experiences and the nuances of them.
I think that for those writing biography, it reminds us that there is always enough, and that it is okay also to, I think, push our archival sources where we need them to go and also recognize that there are gaps, and gaps aren't necessarily problems, right? But opportunities to kind of think through different choices of our subjects. For just us people who are readers and enjoyers of biography, I think that biography works best when it can be a prism to help you understand a period of time. And more so than anybody, helps us understand the entirety of the 20th century. Not from, kind of up on high in the Malcolm Martin, kind of way, but what it was like for Black folk every day trying to struggle on the ground. And then finally, we can debate the usefulness of her Black nationalism and the practicalness of it, but she stayed the course. Right? She picked an ideology. She picked a vision of freedom. She picked a strategy and she stuck with it, no matter what it cost her. And it did cost her things. And so I think in this moment, when we feel kind of like the world may be shifting under our feet, it's a reminder to stay the course, to decide what your values are. And then it's really interesting. Some of her values seemed very kind of fringe, like reparations. And now those are relatively mainstream, at least the conversation about it. And it is part of our vernacular, which is thanks to her. Other things like Black people having a nation state is still seen as very kind of radical. But the point here is that some people come around and you've got to just stick with what it is that you believe and let the people come to you.
Yes. And I also want to say, when you mentioned that her seeing the 20th century not from on high, but kind of more on the ground, but let's also give her credit for influencing those who are on high, particularly many people, Kwame Ture, Malcolm X. You want to talk a little bit about her experience with Malcolm X?
Yeah, so she says that she first actually sees Malcolm when he's just at his best, speaking in an open air protest in Harlem. But she's excited because she has not seen somebody kind of be able to captivate an audience and talk the way Malcolm does since, quite frankly, Garvey. And in particular, talk about the values and things that she believes in, by and large, right? So she starts messaging her old comrades, being like, "We got our guy," And over time, she starts to befriend him. Their relationship is at its strongest when she lives in Philadelphia in the early 1960s. And he is on the cusp of leaving the Nation of Islam, but does stop by her house, which was kind of a nationalist meeting ground, as it were, in the early 1960s. There were old Garveyites there, there were young college organizers, and her sisters would hold court and hold political education classes. And she says that they were always kind of pushing him to articulate more of this human rights stance, to talk more about Africa, to be more involved. But Malcolm would always say, "Elijah Muhammad has to give me permission to do so." But they felt like they were laying the seeds. And so she was excited when he left the Nation of Islam and devastated by his assassination, because she felt like, he was their next big leader and she was ready to get behind him.
Yeah. It is so sad when his life is cut short, there's so many people who were really just able to embrace him at that point too, because he was expanding in so many ways. And it just would have been wonderful to see how that would have played out. But again, congratulations on this wonderful book on Queen Mother Moore, who's been everywhere all the time in the 20th century. I mean, it's great because we get to see it through her eyes, the good, the bad, the highs, and the lows. And there's so many nuanced lessons to learn from her experiences. And congratulations, because you do bring them out brilliantly. And thank you for doing this.
Thank you for being such a thoughtful reader of the book.
That was award-winning author and scholar Ashley D. Farmer talking about her latest book, Queen Mother: Black Nationalism, Reparations, and the Untold Story of Audre Moore. It was published by Pantheon in November 2025, and this interview was recorded in January 2026 via Zoom by fellow biographer and bio member Tamara Payne. To learn more about bio, or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillinganes created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shireen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.